I seen the kid afterwards sitting naked on the bench outside the showers. He had a big bruise coming on the side of his chest, but he didn't seem to mind it at all. He was no crybaby. The son of a bitch was too dumb to feel pain, some people said later. Too dumb and crazy. But I've known plenty of dumb players in my time, and being dumb never stopped them from bitching over their boo-boos. How about all those signs, kid? I asked, thinking I would cheer him up if he needed cheering. What signs? He says, and I could see by the puzzled look on his face that he wasn't joking a bit. That was Blockade Billy for you. He would have stood in front of a semi if the guy behind the wheel was driving down the third baseline and trying to score on him, but otherwise, he didn't have a fucking clue. We played a two-game series with Detroit before hitting the road again, and lost both. Danny Dew was on the mound for the second one, and he couldn't blame the kid for the way it went. He was gone before the third inning was over, sat in the dugout whining about the cold weather. It wasn't cold. The way Harrington misplayed a fly ball out in right. Harrington would have needed rockets on his heels to get to that one before it dropped. And the bad calls he got from that son of a bitch Wenders behind the plate. On that last one, he might have had a point. High Wenders didn't like the Dew, never had. Ran him in two ball games the year before. But I didn't see any bad calls that day, and I was standing less than 90 feet away. The kid hit safe in both games, including a home run and a triple. Nor did Deuson hold the hot bat against him, which would have been his ordinary behavior. He was one of those guys who wanted fellows to understand there was one big star on the Titans, and it wasn't them. But he liked the kid. He really seemed to think the kid was his lucky charm. And the kid liked him. They went bar hopping after the game, had about 1,000 drinks, and visited a whorehouse to celebrate the Dew's first loss of the season, and showed up the next day for the trip to KC, pale and shaky. The kid got laid last night, Dew confided in me as we rode out to the airport in the team bus. I think it was his first time. That's the good news. The bad news is that I don't think he remembers it. We had a bumpy plane ride. Most of them were back then. Lousy prop-driven buckets. It's a wonder we didn't all get killed like Buddy Holly and the big fucking bopper. The kids spent most of the trip throwing up in the can at the back of the plane, while right outside the door a bunch of guys sat playing AC Deucey and tossing them the usual funny stuff. Get any on ya? Want a fork and knife to cut that up a little? Then the next day, the son of a bitch goes 5 for 5 at Municipal Stadium, including a pair of jacks. There was also another Blockade Billy play. By then, he could have taken out a patent. This time, the victim was Cleet Boyer. Again, it was Blockade Billy, down with the left shoulder, and up and over Mr. Boyer went, landing flat on his back in the left batter's box. There were some differences, though. The rook used both hands on the tag, and there was no bloody foot or strained Achilles tendon. Boyer just got up, walked back to the dugout, dusting his ass and shaking his head like he didn't quite know where he was. Oh, and we lost the game, in spite of the kid's 5 hits. 11-10 was the final score, or something like that. Gansey Burgess's knuckleball wasn't dancing that day. The Athletics feasted on it. We won the next game, lost a squeaker on getaway day. The kid hit in both games, which made it 16 straight, plus 9 putouts at the plate. 9 in 16 games. That might be a record. If it was in the books, that is. If any of that month's records were in the books. We went to Chicago for 3, and the kid hit in those games too, making it 19 straight. But damn if we didn't lose all 3. Jersey Joe looked at me after the last of those games and said, I don't buy that Lucky Charm stuff. I think Blakely sucks luck. That ain't fair, and you know it, I said. We were going good at the start, and now we're in a bad patch. It'll even out. Maybe, he says. Is Deuson still trying to teach the kid how to drink? Yeah, they're headed off to the loop with some other guys. But they'll come back together, Joe says. I don't get it. By now, Doosan should hate that kid. Doo's been here 5 years, and I know his M.O.
I did, too. When the Doo lost, he had to lay the blame on somebody else. Like that bum Johnny Harrington, or that busher blue suit, High Wenders. The kid's turn in the barrel was overdue. But Danny was still clapping him on the back and promising him he'd be rookie of the goddamn year. Not that the Doo could blame the kid for that day's loss. In the fifth inning of his latest masterpiece, Danny had hucked one to the backstop in the fifth. High, wide, and handsome. That scored one. So then he gets mad, loses his control, and walks the next two. Then Nellie Fox doubled down the line. After that, the Doo got it back together, but by then it was too late. He was on the hook and stayed there. We got a little well in Detroit, took 2 out of 3. The kid hit in all 3 games and made another one of those amazing home plate stands. Then we flew home. By then, the kid from the Davenport Cornholers was the hottest goddamn thing in the American League. There was talk of him doing a Gillette ad. That's an ad I'd like to see, Cy Barbarino said. I'm a fan of comedy.
And you must love looking at yourself in the mirror, Critter Hayward said.
You're a cod, Cy says. What I mean is the kid ain't got no whiskers.
There never was an ad, of course. Blockade Billy's career as a baseball player was almost over. We just didn't know it. We had 3 scheduled at home with the White Sox, but the first one was a washout. The Doo's old pal, High Wenders, was the umpire crew chief, and he gave me the news himself. I'd got to the swamp early because the trunks with our road uniforms in them got sent to Idlewild by mistake, and I wanted to make sure they'd been trucked over. We wouldn't need them for a week, but I was never easy in my mind until such things were taken care of. Wenders was sitting on a little stool outside the umpire's room, reading a paperback with a blonde in step-ins on the cover. "That your wife, High?" I asks.
"My girlfriend," he says. "Go on home, Granny. Weather forecast says that by 3 it's going to be coming down in buckets. I'm just waiting for DePuno and Lopez to get here so I can call the game."
"Okay," I says.
"Thanks."
I started away, and he called after me.
"Granny, is that wonder kid of yours all right in the head? Because he talks to himself behind the plate. Whispers. Never fucking shuts up."
"He's no quiz kid, but he's not crazy, if that's what you mean," I said. I was wrong about that, but who knew?
"What kind of stuff does he say?" "I couldn't hear much the one time I was behind him, the second game against Boston. But I know he talks about himself in that, third person. He says stuff like, 'I can do it, Billy.' And one time when he dropped a foul tip that would have been strike 3, he goes, 'I'm sorry, Billy.'"
"Well, so what? Till I was 5, I had an invisible friend named Sheriff Pete. Me and Sheriff Pete shot up a lot of mining towns together."
"Yeah, but Blakely ain't 5 anymore. Unless he's 5 up here."
Wenders taps the side of his thick skull. "He's apt to have a 5 as the first number in his batting average before long," I says. "That's all I care about. Plus, he's a hell of a stopper. You have to admit that."
"I do," Wenders says. "That little cockknocker has no fear. Another sign that he's not all there in the head."
I wasn't going to listen to an umpire run down one of my players any more than that, so I changed the subject and asked him, joking but not joking, if he was going to call the game tomorrow fair and square, even though his favorite Doobug was throwing.
"I always call it fair and square," he says. "Doosan's a conceited glory hog who's got his spot all picked out in Cooperstown. He'll do 100 things wrong and never take the blame once. And he's an argumentative son of a bitch who knows better than to start in with me because I won't stand for it. That said, I'll call it straight up just like I always do. I can't believe you'd ask."
"And I can't believe you'd sit there scratching your ass and calling our catcher next door to a congenital idiot," I thought, "but you did." I took my wife out to dinner that night.
and we had a very nice time. Danced to Lester Lannon's band, as I recall. Got a little romantic in the taxi afterward. Slept well. I didn't sleep well for quite some time afterward. Lots of bad dreams. Danny Dewson took the ball in what was supposed to be the afternoon half of a twi-nighter, but the world as it applied to the Titans had already gone to hell. We just didn't know it. No one did except for Joe DiPunno. By the time night fell, we knew we were fucked for the season because our first 22 games were almost surely going to be erased from the record books, along with any official acknowledgement of Blockade Billy Blakely. I got in late because of traffic, but figured it didn't matter because the uniform snafu was sorted out. Most of the guys were already there, dressing or playing poker or just sitting around shooting the shit. Dewson and the kid were over in the corner by the cigarette machine, sitting in a couple of folding chairs, the kid with his uniform pants on. Dewson still wearing nothing but his jock. Not a pretty sight. I went over to get a pack of Winston's and listened in. Danny was doing most of the talking. "That fucking Wenders hates my ass," he says. "He hates your ass," the kid says, then adds, "That fucker." "You bet he is. You think he wants to be the one behind the plate when I get my 200th? "No," the kid says. "You bet he don't. But I'm going to win today just despite him. And you're going to help me, Bill. Right?" "Right. Sure, Bill's gonna help. He'll squeeze like a motherfucker." "Will he? Will he squeeze like a motherfucker? I just said he will, so you pull everything back." "I'll pull everything back. You're my good luck charm, Billy boy." And the kid grinning, "I'm your good luck charm." "Yeah, now listen." It was funny and creepy at the same time. The dude was intense, leaning forward, eyes flashing while he talked. Everything Wenders had said about him was true, but he left one thing out. The dude was a competitor. He wanted to win, the way Bob Gibson did. Like Gibby, he'd do anything he could get away with to make that happen, and the kid was eating it up with a spoon. I almost said something because I wanted to break up that connection. Talking about it to you, I think maybe my subconscious mind had already put a lot of it together. Maybe that's bullshit. But I don't think so. In any case, I left him alone, just got my butts and walked away. Hell, if I'd opened my bazoo, Dewson would have told me to put a sock in it anyway. He didn't like to be interrupted when he was holding court. And while I might not have given much of a shit about that on any other day, you tend to leave a guy alone when it's his turn to toe the rubber in front of the 40,000 people who are paying his salary, especially when he's up for the big 200. I went over to Joe's office to get the lineup card, but the office door was shut and the blinds were down. An almost unheard-of thing on a game day. The slats weren't closed, so I peeked through. Joe had the phone to his ear and one hand over his eyes. I knocked on the glass. He started so hard he almost fell out of his chair, then looked around, and I saw he was crying. I never saw him cry in my life, not before or after. But he was crying that day. His face was pale and his hair was wild. What little hair he had. He waved me away, then went back to talking on the phone. I started across the locker room to the coach's office, which was really the equipment room. Halfway there, I stopped. The big pitcher-catcher conference had broken up, and the kid was pulling on his uniform shirt, the one with the big blue 19. And I saw the Band-Aid was back on the second finger of his right hand. I walked over and put a hand on his shoulder. He smiled at me. The kid had a real sweet smile when he used it. "Hi, Granny," he says. But his smile began to fade when he saw I wasn't smiling back. "You all ready to play?" I asked. "Sure." "Good. But I want to tell you something first. The dude's a hell of a pitcher,
But as a human being, he ain't ever gonna get past double A. He'd walk on his grandmother's broken back to get a win. And you matter a hell of a lot less to him than his grandmother. I'm his good luck charm, he says indignantly. But underneath the indignation, he looked ready to cry. Maybe so, I said, but that's not what I'm talking about. There's such a thing as getting too pumped up for a game. A little is good, but too much, and a fellow's apt to bust wide open. I don't get you. If you popped and went flat like a bad tire, the dew wouldn't give much of a shit. He'd just find himself a brand new lucky charm. You shouldn't talk like that. Him and me's friends. I'm your friend, too. More important, I'm one of the coaches on this team. I'm responsible for your welfare, and I'll talk any goddamn way I want, especially to a rook, and you'll listen. Are you listening? I'm listening. I'm sure he was, but he wasn't looking. He'd cast his eyes down, and sullen red roses were blooming on those smooth little boy cheeks of his. I don't know what kind of a rig you've got under that Band-Aid, and I don't want to know. All I know is I saw it in the first game you played for us, and somebody got hurt. I haven't seen it since, and I don't want to see it today, because if you got caught, it'd be you caught, not the Dew. I just cut myself, he says, all sullen. Right, shaving. But I don't want to see it on your finger when you go out there. I'm looking after your own best interests. Would I have said that if I hadn't seen Joe so upset he was crying? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think I was also looking after the best interests of the game, which I loved then and now. Virtual bowling can't hold a candle, believe me. I walked away before he could say anything else, and I didn't look back, partly because I didn't want to see what was under the Band-Aid. Mostly because Joe was standing in his office door beckoning to me. I won't swear there was more gray in his hair, but I won't swear there wasn't. I came into the office and closed the door. An awful idea occurred to me. It made a kind of sense, given the look on his face. Jesus, Joe, is it your wife? Or the kids? Did something happen to one of the kids? He started like I'd just woken him out of a dream.
Jesse and the kids are fine. But George, oh, God, I can't believe it. This is such a mess.
And he put the heels of his palms against his eyes. A sound came out of him, but it wasn't a sob. It was a laugh, the most terrible, fucked-up laugh I ever heard. What is it? Who called you?
I have to think,
he says, but not to me. It was himself he was talking to.
I have to decide. How am I going to?
He took his hands off his eyes, and he seemed a little more like himself.
You're managing today, Granny.
Me? I can't manage. The Dew would blow his stack. He's going for his 200th again, and
none of that matters. Don't you see? Not now.
What?
Just shut up and make out a lineup card. As for that kid,
he thought, then shook his head.
Oh, hell, let him play. Why not? Shit. Bat him fifth. I was going to move him up anyway.
Of course he's going to play, I said. Who else would catch Danny?
Oh, fuck Danny Dewson, he says.
Cap, Joey, tell me what happened.
No, he says. I got to think about it first. What I'm going to say to the guys. And the reporters.
He slapped his brow as if this part of it had just occurred to him.
Those overbred assholes. Shit.
Then, talking to himself again.
But let the guys have this game. They deserve that much. Maybe the kid, too. Hell, maybe he'll bat for the cycle.
He laughed some more, then went upside his own head to make himself stop. I don't understand.
You will. Go on, get out of here. Make any old lineup you want. Pull the names out of a hat, why don't you?
It doesn't matter. Only make sure you tell the umpire crew chief you're running the show. I guess that'd be Winders.
I walked down the hall to the umpire's room like a man in a dream and told Winders that I'd be making out the lineup and managing the game from the third base box. He asked me what was wrong with Joe, and I said Joe was sick. That was the first game I managed until I got the Athletics in 63, and it was a short one, because, as you probably know if you've done your research, High Winders ran me in the sixth. I don't remember much about it anyway. I had so much on my mind that I felt like a man in a dream. But I did have sense enough to do one thing, and that was to check the kid's right hand before he ran out on the field. There was no Band-Aid on the second finger, and no cut either. I didn't even feel relieved. I just kept seeing Joe DiPunno's red eyes and haggard mouth. That was Danny Dew's last good game ever, and he never did get his 200. He tried to come back in 58, but it was no good. He claimed the double vision was gone, and maybe it was true, but he couldn't hardly get the pill over the plate anymore. No spot in Cooperstown for Danny. Joe was right. That kid did suck luck. But that afternoon, Dew was the best I ever saw him. His fastball hopping, his curve snapping like a whip. For the first four innings, they couldn't touch him at all. Just wave the stick and take a seat, fellas. He struck out six, and the rest were infield groundouts. Only trouble was Kinder was almost as good. We'd gotten one lousy hit, a two-out double by Harrington in the bottom of the third. Now, it's the top of the fifth. The first batter goes down easy. Then Walt Dropo comes up, hits one deep into the left field corner, and takes off like a bat out of hell. The crowd saw Harry Keene still chasing the ball while Dropo's legging for second, and they understood it could be an inside-the-park job. The chanting started. Only a few voices at first, then more and more, getting deeper and louder. It put a chill up me from the crack of my ass to the nape of my neck.
Blockade! Blockade! Blockade!
Like that. The orange signs started going up. People were on their feet and holding them over their heads. Not waving them like usual, just holding them up. I have never seen anything like it.
Blockade! Blockade! Blockade!
At first, I thought there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell. By then, Dropo's steaming for third with all the stops pulled out. But Keene pounced on the ball and made a perfect throw to Barbarino at short. The Rook, meanwhile, is standing on the third base side of home plate with his glove held out, making a target, and Cy hit the goddamn pocket! The crowd's chanting. Dropo's sliding, spikes up. The kid don't mind. He goes on his knees and dives over him. High Winders was where he was supposed to be, that time at least, leaning over the play. A cloud of dust goes up, and out of it comes Winder's upraised thumb.
You're out!
Mr. King, the fans went nuts. Walt Dropo did too. He was up and dancing around like a coked-up kid at a record hop. He couldn't believe it! The kid was scraped halfway up his left forearm. Not bad, just blood sweat. But enough for old Boney Dadier, he was our trainer, to come out and slap a Band-Aid on it. So the kid got his Band-Aid after all, only this one was legit. The fans stayed on their feet during the whole medical consultation, waving their road closed signs and chanting, Blockade! Blockade! Like they wouldn't ever get enough of it. The kid didn't seem to notice. He was in another world. He was the whole time he was with the Titans, now that I think of it. He just put on his mask, went back behind the plate, and squatted down, business as usual. Bubba Phillips came up, lined out to Lathrop at first, and that was the fifth. When the kid came up in the bottom of the inning and struck out on three pitches, the crowd still gave him a standing O. That time, He noticed and tipped his cap when he went back to the dugout. Only time he ever did it. Not because he was snotty, but because, well, I already said it, that other world thing. Okay, top of the sixth. Over 50 years later, and I still get a red ass when I think of it. Kinder's up first and loops out to third, just like a pitcher should. Then comes Louis Aparicio, little Louis. The dew whines and fires. Aparicio fouls it off, high and lazy behind home plate on the third base side of the screen. The kid throws away his mask and sprints after it, head back and glove out. Wenders trailed him, but not close like he should have done. He didn't think the kid had a chance. It was lousy goddamn umping. The kid's off the grass and on the track by the low wall between the field and the box seats, neck craned, looking up. 2 dozen people in those first and second row box seats also looking up, most of them waving their hands in the air. You know, this is one thing I don't understand about fans, and never will. It's a fucking baseball, for the love of God. An item that sold for 75 cents back then. Everybody knew it, but when fans see one in reach at the ballpark, they turn into fucking Danny Dew in order to get their hands on it. Never mind standing back and letting the man trying to catch it, their man, and in a tight ball game, do his job. I saw it all. Saw it clear. That mile-high pop-up came down on our side of the wall. The kid was going to catch it. Then some long-armed bozo in one of those Titans jerseys they sold on the Esplanade reached over and ticked it so the ball bounced off the edge of the kid's glove and fell to the ground. I was so sure Wenders would call Aparicio out. It was clear interference that at first I couldn't believe what I was seeing when he gestured for the kid to go back behind the plate and for Aparicio to resume the box. When I got it, I ran out waving my arms. The crowd started cheering me and booing Wenders, which is no way to win friends and influence people when you're arguing a call, but I was too goddamn mad to care. I wouldn't have stopped if Mahatma Gandhi had walked out on the field butt naked and urging us to make peace. Interference! I yelled. Clear as day, clear as the nose on your face. It was in the stands, and that makes it anyone's ball, Wender says. Go on back to your little nest and let's get this show on the road. The kid didn't care. He was talking to his pal the Dew. That was all right. I didn't care that he didn't care. All I wanted at that moment was to tear High Wenders a fresh new asshole. I'm not ordinarily an argumentative man. All the years I managed the A's, I only got thrown out of games twice. But that day, I would have made Billy Martin look like a peacenik. You didn't see it, High. You were trailing too far back. You didn't see shit. I wasn't trailing, and I saw it all. Now get back, Granny. I ain't kidding. If you didn't see that long-armed son of a bitch... Here, a lady in the second row put her hands over her little boy's ears and pursed up her mouth at me in an oh-you-nasty-man look. That long-armed son of a bitch reach out and tick that ball? You were goddamn trailing! Jesus Christ! The man in the jersey starts shaking his head. Who, me? Not me. But he's also wearing a big, embarrassed, suck-ass grin. Wenders saw it, knew what it meant, then looked away. That's it, he says to me, and in the reasonable voice that means you're one smart crack from drinking a Rheingold in the locker room. You've had your say. Now you can either go back to the dugout or you can listen to the rest of the game on the radio. Take your pick. I went back to the dugout. Aparicio stood back in with a big shit-eating grin on his face. He knew. Sure he did. And made the most of it. The guy never hit many home runs, but when the Dew sent in a change-up that didn't change, Louis cranked it, high, wide, and handsome to the deepest part of the park. Nosey Norton was playing center, and he never even turned around. Aparicio circled the bases, serene as the Queen Mary coming in to dock, while the crowd screamed at him, denigrated his relatives, and hurled hate down on High Wender's head. Wenders heard none of it, which is the chief umpirely skill. He just got a fresh ball out of his coat pocket and inspected it for dings and doinks.
Watching him do that, I lost it entirely. I rushed out to home plate and started shaking both fists in his face. "That's your run, you fucking busher," I screamed. "Too fucking lazy to chase after a foul ball, and now you've got an RBI for yourself. Jam it up your ass! Maybe you'll find your glasses!" The crowd loved it. Highwinders? Not so much. He pointed at me, threw his thumb back over his shoulder, and walked away. The crowd started booing and shaking their road closed signs. Some threw bottles, cups, and half-eaten Franks onto the field. It was a circus. "Don't you walk away from me, you fat-ass, blind, lazy, son-of-a-bitching bastard!" I screamed and chased after him. Someone from our dugout grabbed me before I could grab Wenders, which I meant to do. I had lost touch with reality. The crowd was chanting, "Kill the ump! Kill the ump! Kill the ump!" I'll never forget that, because it was the same way they'd been chanting, "Blockade! Blockade!" "If your mother was here, she'd be throwing shit at you too, you bat-blind busher!" I screamed, and then they hauled me into the dugout. Gansey Burgess, our knuckleballer, managed the last three innings of that horror show. He also pitched the last two. You might find that in the record books, too, if there were any records of that lost spring. The last thing I saw on the field was Danny Dewson and Blockade Billy standing on the grass between the plate and the mound. The kid had his mask tucked under his arm. The dew was whispering in his ear. The kid was listening. He always listened when the dew talked. But he was looking at the crowd. 40,000 fans on their feet, men, women, and children, yelling, "Kill the ump! Kill the ump! Kill the ump!" There was a bucket of balls halfway down the hall between the dugout and the locker room. I kicked it and sent balls rolling every which way. If I'd stepped on one of them and fallen on my ass, it would have been the perfect end to a perfect fucking afternoon at the ballpark. Joe was in the locker room, sitting on a bench outside the showers. By then, he looked 70 instead of just 50. There were three other guys in there with him. Two were uniformed cops. The third was in a suit, but you only had to take one look at his hard roast beef of a face to know he was a cop, too. "Game over early?" this one asked me. He was sitting on a folding chair with his big old cop thighs spread and straining his seersucker pants. The blue suits were on one of the benches in front of the lockers. "It is for me," I said. I was still so mad I didn't even care about the cops. To Joe I said, "Fucking Wenders ran me. I'm sorry, Cap, but it was a clear case of interference, and that lazy son of a bitch..."
"It doesn't matter," Joe said. "The game isn't going to count. I don't think any of our games are going to count. Kerwin will appeal to the commissioner, of course, but..."
"What are you talking about?" I asked. Joe sighed. Then he looked at the guy in the suit.
"You tell him, Detective Lombardazzi," he said. "I can't bear to."
"Does he need to know?" Lombardazzi asked. "He's looking at me like I'm some kind of bug he's never seen before." It was a look I didn't need on top of everything else, but I kept my mouth shut. Because I knew three cops, one of them a detective, don't show up in the locker room of a Major League Baseball team if it isn't goddamn serious.
"If you want him to hold the other guys long enough for you to get the Blakely kid out of here, I think he does need to," Joe says.
From above us there came a cry from the fans, followed by a groan, followed by a cheer. None of us paid any attention to what turned out to be the end of Danny Dewson's baseball career. The cry was when he got hit in the forehead by a Larry Doby line drive. The groan was when he fell on the pitcher's mound like a tagged prize fighter. And the cheer was when he picked himself up and gestured that he was okay, which he was not. But he pitched the rest of the sixth and the seventh, too. Didn't give up a run, either. Gansey made him come out before the eighth when he saw the dew wasn't walking straight. Danny all the time claiming he was perfectly okay, that the big purple goose egg raising up over his left eyebrow was nothing. He'd had lots worse.
and the kids saying the same. It ain't nothing. It ain't nothing. Little Sir Echo. Us, down in the clubhouse, didn't know any of that. No more than Deucen knew he might have been tagged worse in his career, but it was the first time part of his brain had sprung a leak.
His name isn't Blakely, Lombardozzi says. It's Eugene Katsanis.
Katswatsis? Where's Blakely, then?
William Blakely's dead. Has been for a month. His parents, too.
I gaped at him. What are you talking about?
So he told me the stuff I'm sure you already know, Mr. King. But maybe I can fill in a few blanks. The Blakeleys lived in Clarence, Iowa, a wide patch of not much an hour's drive from Davenport. Made it convenient for Ma and Pa because they could go to most of their son's minor league games. Blakely had a successful farm, an 800-acre job. One of their hired men wasn't much more than a boy. His name was Gene Katsanis, an orphan who'd grown up in the Ottershaw Christian Home for Boys. He was no farmer, and not quite right in the head, but he was a hell of a baseball player. Katsanis and Blakely played against each other on a couple of church teams and together on the local Babe Ruth team, which won the state tournament all 3 years the two of them played together, and once went as far as the national semis. Blakely went to high school and starred on that team too, but Katsanis wasn't school material. Slopping the hogs material and ball-playing material is what he was, although he was never supposed to be as good as Billy Blakely. Nobody so much as considered such a thing. Until it happened, that is. Blakely's father hired him because the kid worked cheap, sure, but mostly because he had enough natural talent to keep Billy sharp. For $25 a week, the kid got a fielder and a batting practice pitcher. The old man got a cow milker and a shit shoveler. Not a bad deal, at least for them. Whatever you've found in your research probably favors the Blakely family. Am I right? Because they had been around those parts for four generations, because they were rich farmers, and because Katsanis wasn't nothing but a state kid who started life in a liquor carton on a church step and had several screws loose upstairs. And why was that? Because he was born dumb? Or because he got the crap beaten out of him 3 and 4 times a week in that home before he got old enough and big enough to defend himself? I know a lot of the beatings came because he had a habit of talking to himself. That came out in the newspapers later on. Katsanis and Billy practiced just as hard once Billy got into the Titans farm system. During the off-season, you know, probably throwing and hitting in the barn once the snow got too deep outside. But Katsanis got kicked off the local town team and wasn't allowed to go to the cornholers' workouts during Billy's second season with them. During his first one, Katsanis had been allowed to participate in some of the workouts, even in some inter-squad games, if they were a man shy. It was all pretty informal and loosey-goosey back then, not like now, when the insurance company shit a brick if a major leaguer so much as grabs a bat without wearing a helmet. What I think happened, feel free to correct me if you know better, is that the kid, whatever other problems he might have had, continued to grow and mature as a ball player. Blakely didn't. You see that all the time. Two kids who both look like Babe fucking Ruth in high school. Same height, same weight, same speed, same 20-20 peepers, but one of them is able to play at the next level. And the next, while the other one starts to fall behind. This much I did hear later. Billy Blakely didn't start out as a catcher. He got switched from center field when the kid who was catching broke his arm. And that kind of switch isn't a real good sign. It's like the coach is sending a message, you'll do, but only until someone better shows up. I think Blakely got jealous. I think his old man got jealous. And I think maybe Mom did too. Maybe especially Mom. Because sports moms can be the worst. I think maybe they pulled a few strings to keep Katsanis from playing locally and from showing up for the Davenport cocksuckers workouts. They could have done it because they were a wealthy,
long-established Iowa family, and Gene Katsanis was a nobody who grew up in an orphan home, a Christian orphan home that was probably hell on earth. I think maybe Billy got ragging on the kid once too often and once too hard. Or it could have been the dad or the mom. Maybe it was over the way he milked the cows. Or maybe he didn't shovel the shit just right that one time. But I'll bet the bottom line was baseball and plain old jealousy. The green-eyed monster. For all I know, the cornholer's manager told Blakely he might be sent down to Single-A in Clearwater. And getting sent down a rung when you're only 20, when you're supposed to be going up the ladder, is a damn good sign that your career in organized baseball is going to be a short one. But however it was, and whoever, it was a bad mistake. The kid could be sweet when he was treated right. We all knew that. But he wasn't right in the head. And he could be dangerous. I knew that even before the cops showed up because of what happened in the very first game of the season. Billy Anderson. The county sheriff found all three Blakeleys in the barn, Lombardozzi said. Katsani slashed their throats. Sheriff said it looked like a razor blade. I just gaped at him. What must have happened is this, Joe said in a heavy voice. Kerwin McCaslin called around for a backup catcher when our guys got hurt down in Florida. And the manager of the Cornhuskers said he had a boy who might fill the bill for 3 or 4 weeks, assuming we didn't need him to hit for average, because he said this kid wouldn't do that. But he did, I says. Because he wasn't Blakely, Lombardozzi says. By then Blakely and his parents must already have been dead a couple of days, at least. The Katsanis kid was keeping house, all by himself. And not all his screws were loose. He was smart enough to answer the phone when it rang. He took the call from the manager and said, sure, Billy'd be glad to go to New Jersey. And before he left, as Billy, he called around to the neighbors in the feed store downtown, told them the Blakeleys had been called away on a family emergency, and he was taking care of things. Pretty smart for a loony, wouldn't you say? He's not a loony, I told him. Well, he cut the throats of the people who took him in and gave him a job, and he killed all the cows so the neighbors wouldn't hear them bawling to be milked at night. But have it your way. I know the DA's going to agree with you, because he wants to see Katsanis get the rope. That's how they do it in Iowa, you know. I turned to Joe. How could a thing like this happen? Because he was good, Joe said, and because he wanted to play ball. The kid had Billy Blakely's ID, and this was back in the days when picture IDs were unheard of. The two kids matched up pretty well. Blue eyes, dark hair, 6 feet tall. But mostly, yeah, it happened because the kid was good and wanted to play ball. Good enough to get almost a month in the pros, Lombardozzi said, and over our heads a cheer went up. Billy Blockade had just gotten his last big league hit, a homer. Then day before yesterday, the LP gas man went out to the Blakely farm. Other folks had been there before, but they read the note Katsanis left on the door and went away. Not the gas man. He filled the tanks behind the barn, and the barn was where the bodies were, cows and Blakely's both. The weather had finally turned warm, and he smelled them, which is pretty much the way our story ends. Now, your manager here wants him arrested with as little fuss as possible and with as little danger to the other players on your team as possible. That's fine with me. So your job is to hold the rest of the guys in the dugout, Jersey Joe says. Send Blakely, Katsanis, down here on his own. He'll be gone when the rest of the guys get to the locker room. Then we'll try to sort this clusterfuck out. What the hell do I tell them? Team meeting. Free ice cream. I don't care.
You just hold them for 5 minutes.
I says to Lombardazzi, no one tipped? No one? You mean no one heard the radio broadcasts and tried calling Pop Blakely to say how great it was that his kid was tearing up the bigs?
I imagine one or two might have tried, Lombardazzi said. Folks from Iowa do come to the big city from time to time, I'm told, and I imagine a few people visiting New York listened to the Titans or read about them in the paper.
I prefer the Yankees,
one of the blue suits chimes in.
If I want your opinion, I'll rattle the bars in your cage, Lombardazzi said. Until then, shut up and die right.
I looked at Joe, feeling sick. Getting a bad call and getting run off the field during my first managerial stint now seemed like the very least of my problems.
Get him in here alone, Joe said. I don't care how. The guy shouldn't have to see this.
He thought it over and added, and the kid shouldn't have to see them seeing it, no matter what he did.
If it matters, and I know it don't, we lost that game 2-1. All three runs were solo shots. Minnie Minoso hit the game winner off a Gansey in the top of the ninth. The kid made the final out. He whiffed in his first at bat as a Titan. He whiffed in his last one. Baseball is also a game of balance.
But none of our guys cared about the game. When I got up there, they were gathered around the Dew, who was sitting on the bench, and telling them he was fine, goddammit, just a little dizzy.
But he didn't look fine, and our old excuse for a doc looked pretty grave. He wanted Danny down at Newark General for x-rays.
Fuck that, Dew says. I just need a couple of minutes. I'm all right, I tell you. Jesus, Bones, cut me a break.
Blakely, I said, go on down to the locker room. Mr. DiPunno wants to see you.
Coach DiPunno wants to see me? In the locker room? Why?
Something about the Rookie of the Month award, I said. It just popped into my head from nowhere. There was no such thing back then, but the kid didn't know that.
The kid looks at Danny Dew, and the Dew flaps his hand at him. Go on, get out of here, kid. You played a good game. Not your fault. You're still lucky. And fuck anyone who says different.
Then he says, all of you get out of here. Give me some breathing room.
Hold off on that, I says. Joe wants to see him alone. Give him a little one-to-one congratulations, I guess.
Kid, don't wait around. Just scat was how I meant to finish. But I didn't have to. Blakely or Katsanis? He was already gone. And you know what happened after that.
If the kid had gone straight down the hall to the umpire's room, he would have gotten collared because the locker room was on the way. Instead, he cut through our box room, where luggage was stored and where we also had a couple of massage tables and a whirlpool bath. We'll never know for sure why he did that, but I think the kid knew something was wrong.
Crazy or not, he must have known the roof was going to fall in on him eventually. In any case, he came out on the far side of the locker room, walked down to the ump's room, and knocked on the door. By then, the rig he probably learned how to make in the Ottershaw Christian home was back on his second finger. One of the older boys probably showed him how, that's what I think.
Kid, if you want to stop getting beaten up all the time, make yourself one of these.
He never put it back in his locker after all, you see. Just tucked it into his pocket. And he didn't bother with the Band-Aid after the game, which tells me he knew he didn't have anything to hide anymore.
He raps on the umpire's door and says, urgent telegram for Mr. Highwinders.
Crazy but not stupid, you see. I don't know what would have happened if one of the other umps on the crew had opened up. But it was Wenders himself, and I'm betting his life was over even before he realized it wasn't a Western Union delivery boy standing there.
It was a razor blade, see?
Or a piece of one, anyway. When it wasn't needed, it stayed inside a little tin band, like a kid's pretend finger ring. Only, when he balled his right fist and pushed on the band with the ball of his thumb, that little sliver of a blade popped up on a spring. Wenders opened the door
and Katsanis swept it across his neck and cut his throat with it. When I saw the puddle of blood after he was taken away in handcuffs, oh my God, such a pool of it there was. All I could think of was those 40,000 people screaming, "Kill the ump!" the same way they'd been screaming, "Blockade!" No one really means it, but the kid didn't know that either. Especially not after the Dew poured a lot of poison in his ears about how Wenders was out to get both of them. When the cops ran out of the locker room, Billy Blockade was just standing there, with blood all down the front of his white home uniform, and Wenders laying at his feet. Nor did he try to fight or slash when the blue suits grabbed him. No, he just stood there, whispering to himself, "I got him, Dew. I got him, Billy. He won't make no more bad calls now. I got him for all of us." That's where the story ends, Mr. King. The part of it I know, at least. As far as the Titans go, you could look it up, as old Casey used to say. All those games canceled out, and all the double headers we played to make them up. How we ended up with old Hubie Ratner behind the plate after all, and how he batted 185. Well below what they now call the Mendoza line. How Danny Dewson was diagnosed with something called an intracranial bleed and had to sit out the rest of the season. How he tried to come back in 1958. That was sad. 5 outings. In 3 of them, he couldn't get the ball over the plate. And the other 2... Do you remember the last Red Sox-Yankees playoff game in 2004, how Kevin Brown started for the Yankees, and the Sox scored 6 goddamn runs off him in the first 2 innings? That's how Danny Dew pitched in 58, when he actually managed to get the ball over the dish. He had nothing. And still, after all that, we managed to finish ahead of the Senators and the Athletics. Only... Jersey Joe DiPono had a heart attack during the World Series that year. Might have been the same day the Russians put the Sputnik up. They took him out of County Stadium on a stretcher. He lived another 5 years, but he was a shadow of his former self, and of course he never managed again. He said the kid sucked luck, and he was more right than he knew, Mr. King. That kid was a black hole for luck. For himself as well. I'm sure you know how his story ended. How he was taken to Essex County Jail and held there for extradition. How he swallowed a bar of soap and choked to death on it. I can't think of a worse way to go. That was a nightmare season, no doubt. And still, telling you about it brought back some good memories. Mostly I think of how old Swampy would flush orange when all those fans raised their signs. "Road closed by order of Blockade Billy." Yep, I bet the fellow who thought those up made a goddamn mint. But you know, the people who bought them got fair value. When they stood up with them held over their heads, they were part of something bigger than themselves. That can be a bad thing. Just think of all the people who turned out to see Hitler at his rallies. But this was a good thing. Baseball is a good thing. Always was. Always will be. Blockade. 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 Still gives me a chill to think of it. Still echoes in my head. That kid was the real thing, crazy or not. Luck sucker or not. Mr. King, I think I'm all talked out. Do you have enough? Good. I'm glad. You come back anytime you want. But not on Wednesday afternoon. That's when they have their goddamn virtual bowling and you can't hear yourself think. Come on Saturday, why don't you? There's a bunch of us always watches the game of the week. We're allowed a couple of beers, and we root like mad bastards. It ain't like the old days, but it ain't bad.
For Flip Thompson, friend and high school catcher, some stand-in for me in one of the early novels I think it was Ben Mears in Salem's Lot, says it's a bad idea to talk about a story you're planning to write. It's like pissing it out on the ground, is how he puts it. Sometimes, though, especially if I'm feeling enthusiastic, I find it hard to take my own advice. That was the case with Mr. Yummy. When I sketched out the rough idea to a friend, he listened carefully and then shook his head. I don't think you've got anything new to say about AIDS, Steve. He paused and added, especially as a straight man. No, and no, and especially no. I hate the assumption that you can't write about something because you haven't experienced it, and not just because it assumes a limit on the human imagination, which is basically limitless. It also suggests that some leaps of identification are impossible. I refuse to accept that, because it leads to the conclusion that real change is beyond us, and so is empathy. The idea is false on the evidence. Like shit, change happens. If the British and Irish can make peace, you gotta believe there's a chance that someday the Jews and Palestinians will work things out. Change only occurs as a result of hard work. I think we'd all agree on that, but hard work isn't enough. It also requires a strenuous leap of the imagination. What is it really like to be in the other guy or gal's shoes? And hey, I never wanted to write a story about AIDS or being gay anyhow. Those things were only the framing device. What I wanted to write about was the brute power of the human sex drive. That power, it seems to me, holds sway over those of every orientation, especially when young. At some point, on the right or wrong night, in a good place or a bad one, desire rises up and will not be denied. Caution is swept away. Cogent thought ceases. Risk no longer matters. That's what I wanted to write about.
Mr. Yummy, read by Peter Friedman.
One. Dave Calhoun was helping Olga Gliukov construct the Eiffel Tower. They had been at it for 6 mornings now, 6 early mornings. In the common room of the Lakeview Assisted Living Center. They were hardly alone in there. Old people rise early. The giant flat screen on the far side started blatting the usual rabble-rousing junk from Fox News at 5:30, and a number of residents were watching it with their mouths agape.
Oh, Olga said. Here's one I've been looking for.
She tapped a piece of girder into place halfway down Gustav Eiffel's masterpiece, created, according to the back of the box, from junk metal. Dave heard the tap of a cane approaching from behind him and greeted the newcomer without turning his head.
Good morning, Ollie. You're up early.
As a young man, Dave wouldn't have believed you could ID someone simply by the sound of his cane. But as a young man, he had never dreamed he would finish his time on Earth in a place where so many people used them.
Good morning right back at you, Ollie Franklin said. And to you, Olga.
She looked up briefly, then back down at the puzzle. 1,000 pieces, according to the box, and most now where they belonged.
These girders are a bugger. I see them floating in front of me every time I close my eyes. I believe I'll go for a smoke and wake up my lungs.
Smoking was supposedly verboten in Lakeview, but Olga and a few other diehards were allowed to slip through the kitchen to the loading dock, where there was a butt can. She rose, tottered, cursed in either Russian or Polish, caught her balance, and shuffled away. Then she stopped and looked back at Dave, eyebrows drawn together.
Live some for me, bub. Do you promise?
He raised his hand, palm out.
So help me God.
Satisfied, she shuffled on, digging in the pocket of her shapeless day dress for her butts and her bick. Ollie raised his own eyebrows.
Since when are you, bub?
He was her husband. You remember, came here with her, died 2 years ago.
All right. And now she's losing it. That's too bad.
Dave shrugged. She'll be 90 in the fall if she makes it. She's entitled to a few slip cogs, and look at this. He gestured at the puzzle which filled an entire card table.
She did most of it herself. I'm just her assistant.
Ollie, who had been a graphic designer in what he called his real life, looked at the nearly completed puzzle gloomily.
La Tour Eiffel. Do you know there was an artist protest when it was under construction? No, but I'm not surprised. The French. The novelist Léon Bois called it a truly tragic street lamp.
Calhoun looked at the puzzle, saw what Blois had meant, and laughed. It did look like a street lamp, sort of.
Some other artist or writer, I can't remember who, claimed that the best view of Paris was from the Eiffel Tower because it was the only view of Paris without the Eiffel Tower in it.
Ollie bent closer, one hand gripping his cane, the other pressed against the small of his back, as if to hold it together. His eyes moved from the puzzle to the scatter of remaining pieces, perhaps 100 in all, then back to the puzzle.
Houston, you may have a problem here.
Dave had already begun to suspect this.
If you're right, it's going to ruin Olga's day.
Oh, she should have expected it. How many times do you think this version of the Eiffel has been assembled and then taken apart again? Old people are as careless as teenagers.
He straightened up.
Would you walk outside in the garden with me? I have something to give you. Also, something to tell you.
Dave studied Ollie.
You okay?
The other chose not to answer this.
Come outside. It's a beautiful morning, warming up nicely.
Ollie led the way toward the patio, his cane tapping out that familiar 1-2-3 rhythm, tossing a good morning wave to someone as he passed the coffee-drinking coterie of TV watchers. Dave followed willingly enough, but slightly mystified. 2. Lakeview was built in a U-shape, with the common room between two extending arms that comprised the assisted living suites, each suite consisting of a sitting room, a bedroom, and the sort of bathroom that came equipped with handrails and a shower chair. These suites were not cheap. Although many of the residents were no longer strictly continent, Dave had begun suffering his own nighttime accidents not long after turning 83, and now kept boxes of PM pull-ups on a high shelf in his closet. It was not the sort of place that smelled of piss and Lysol. The rooms also came with satellite TV. There was a snack buffet in each wing, and twice a month there were wine tasting parties. All things considered, Dave thought, it was a pretty good place to run out the string. The garden between the residence wings was lush, almost orgasmic, with early summer. Paths wandered, and a central fountain splashed. The flowers rioted, but in a genteel, well-barbered way. Here and there were house telephones, where a walker suddenly afflicted with shortness of breath or spreading numbness in the legs could call for assistance. There would be plenty of walkers later on, when those not yet risen or when those in the common room got their fill of Fox News, came out to enjoy the day before it heated up. But for the time being, Dave and Ollie had it to themselves. Once they were through the double doors and down the steps from the wide flagstone patio, both of them descending with care, Ollie stopped and began fumbling in the pocket of the baggy houndstooth check sport coat he was wearing. He brought out a silver pocket watch on a heavy silver chain. He held it out to Dave.
I want you to have this. It was my great-grandfather's. Judging by the engraving inside the cover, he either bought it or had it given to him in 1890.
Dave gazed at the watch, swinging on his chain from Ollie Franklin's slightly palsied hand like a hypnotist's amulet, with amusement and horror.
I can't take that.
Patiently, as if instructing a child, Ollie said,
You can if I give it to you, and I've seen you admire it many and many a time.
It's a family heirloom.
Yes, indeed, and my brother will take it if it's in my effects when I die, which I'm going to do, and soon, perhaps tonight, certainly in the next few days.
Dave didn't know what to say. Still in that same patient tone, Ollie said,
My brother Tom isn't worth the powder it would take to blow him to Des Moines. I have never said as much to him, it would be cruel, but I've said so many times to you, haven't I? Well, yeah. I have supported him through 3 failed businesses and 2 failed marriages. I believe I told you that many times as well, haven't I?
Yes, but...
I did well, and I invested well, Ollie said, beginning to walk and tapping his cane at his own personal code. Tap, 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 tap. I am one of the infamous 1% so reviled by the liberal young. Not by a lot, mind you.
but by enough to have lived comfortably here for the last 3 years while continuing to serve as my younger brother's safety net. I no longer have to perform that service for his daughter, thank God. Martha actually seems to be earning a living for herself, which is a relief. I've made a will, all proper and correct, and in it I've done the proper thing, the family thing. Since I have no wife or children myself, that means leaving everything to Tom. Except this. This is for you. You've been a good friend to me, so please, take it. Dave considered, decided he could give it back when his friend's death premonition passed, and took the watch. He clicked it open and admired the crystal face. 6:22, right on time as far as he could tell. The second hand moved briskly in its own little circle, just above the scrolled 6. "Cleaned several times, but repaired only once," Ollie said, resuming his slow ambulation. "In 1923, according to Grampy, after my father dropped it down the well on the old farm in Hemingford home. Can you imagine that? Over 120 years old and only repaired once. How many human beings on earth can claim that? A dozen? Maybe only 6? You have 2 sons and a daughter, am I right?"
"You are," Dave said.
His friend had grown increasingly frail over the last year, and his hair was nothing but a few baby-fine wisps on his liver-spotted skull, but his mind was ticking along a little better than Olga's. "Or my own," he admitted to himself.
"The watch isn't in my will, but it should go in yours. I'm sure you love all your children equally. You're that kind of guy. But liking is different, isn't it? Leave it to the one you like the best."
That would be Peter, Dave thought, and smiled. Either returning the smile or catching the thought behind it, Ollie's lips parted over his remaining teeth, and he nodded.
"Let's sit down. I'm bushed. It doesn't take much these days."
They sat on one of the benches, and Dave tried to hand the watch back. Ollie pushed his hands out in an exaggerated repelling gesture that was comical enough to make Dave laugh, although he recognized this as a serious matter.